Before I start, I would like to make an apology that I am not the rector of All Souls, because I do know what it's like. Perhaps if you're a visitor and you've seen that the rector is preaching and you've come along to hear him tonight, I do know something of the disappointment that you'll be feeling. I went to see Dustin Hoffman in The Merchant of Venice last year, and I know perfectly well how I would have felt if, when I'd got there, there'd been a stand-in for Dustin Hoffman. I wouldn't have minded missing the play, but I did want to see Dustin Hoffman. So, forgive me for not being Richard this evening. I feel guilty about it. I'd like to start with a question, and I don't know if I'm allowed to do this. I wonder if you could just sort of raise your hand if the reading that John has just read to us was a familiar reading. Yes, I thought that I might not have the element of surprise on my side tonight, because it is quite a famous reading. Sam Goldwyn said that a film should start with an earthquake and then build to a climax. But I think a sermon should as well, but it's not easy when everyone is quite so familiar with the main character and the plot line. I mean, there's a play in the West End called The Mousetrap, which is running, I don't know, I think it's in it something like its 39th glorious year. But I mean, who'd go and see it twice? Who would go and see it twice? I mean, I've seen it once, and I regret that. But who would ever go and see it twice? Because once you've seen it once, you know, the suspense is broken, because there's the familiarity there. The familiarity has killed the suspense, and the familiarity has killed the storyline. And though I doubt in this case if familiarity is going to breed contempt, familiarity with these verses might just breed something much worse than contempt, and that's complacency. And that's our problem tonight. But before I go any further, I'd like to start really just by saying, making a confession, that in fact I've only got 5 words to say tonight. I have only 5 words to say tonight, so how will I spin things out? Well, I'll think of something, but I actually have only 5 words to say tonight. And don't worry, I will tell you when we get to them, because it would be a shame to come all this way and miss them. But before we do get to them, let's remind ourselves of the story, because it's very important that we anchor ourselves in the reading that John gave to us just now. And I'm going to concentrate particularly on verses 6 to 11. Because although it's familiar to some of us, there might be others of us here to whom it isn't familiar, and others still to whom it's completely and excitingly new. Paul is trying to persuade the Philippians to have the same attitudes as Jesus. What attitudes were those? Asked the Philippians. Oh, I'll tell you, says Paul. And then he starts. Have this mind among yourselves, which you have in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the glory of God the Father. So that's the story that we're going to be working with tonight. And it's a story, as you'll see, it's in 3 parts. There in verse 6 is the leaving. The leaving. Jesus leaves his heavenly home. I wonder if you've ever left home. You probably have left home. Well, so did Jesus. Jesus leaves his home. His dad says to him, I'd like you to go to earth, son. And Jesus says, fine. Have you got friends there? And his father says, I will have. And Jesus says, yes. Yes, you will have. And he steps out into the cold. The first part of the story is the leaving. Jesus leaves his heavenly home because he didn't count equality with God as something to be grasped. And then there is the dying. The second part of the story is the dying. Some of us might have felt that Jesus had done enough, that Jesus had done enough by leaving heaven and squeezing into human flesh. The problem wasn't obesity, of course, but divinity. It was divinity that he had to squeeze into restricting, limiting, vulnerable, bleeding human flesh. We might have thought that was enough, but Jesus, in fact, didn't. Instead, Jesus became the greatest postage stamp of all time. You may not have heard of Jesus referred to as a postage stamp before. I use the picture of a postage stamp because the usefulness of a postage stamp consists in sticking to one thing until it gets there. And with the English postal system, that's often a very long time. And it certainly was with Jesus. But you see, Jesus was prepared to stick at one thing until he got there. He was even prepared to stick on a cross in order to scream God's love to the world. So this is a story in three parts. It starts with the leaving. The second part is the dying. And finally, the naming, there in verse 9. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every other name. God points at the cross and he says, "That's what the world thinks of my son." God points at the cross and says, "That's what the world thinks of my son." But God points at the resurrection and says, "That's what I think of my son." It's not a secret that when Monty Python set out to write the film that eventually became The Life of Brian, they actually wanted to write a different film. They wanted to write a spoof of the life of Jesus, and they wanted to call it Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. And that was the production title. And they went away to write the script. And they couldn't. They failed. They couldn't produce a funny script about Jesus. And this shouldn't surprise us because comics mainly work with the flaws in their characters. But you see, with Jesus, they couldn't find any. And so they had to have a complete change of direction, and they invented a new character. They called him Brian, and he became the 13th disciple who was mistaken for the Messiah. And they turned the film not to a film about Jesus Christ, but a film about the lunacies of extreme religion. See, what they discovered was that when they were dealing with Jesus, they were dealing with somebody who was different. Now, they had to learn, the Monty Python team had to learn by trial and error, but they could have saved themselves time by reading Philippians 2, 5 to 11, where Jesus is named for who and what he is. Jesus is Lord, to whom every knee shall bow, including your own. And that is the story before us, since it's not unfamiliar. It's in three parts. It is the leaving, the dying, and the naming. The leaving of the heavenly home, the dying to self, and the naming by the Father. In the language of the kitchen jug, it's the story of somebody who emptied themselves that they might be filled. In the language of the darts match, it's the story of someone who set themselves and their concerns at naught in order to score 180. In the slightly revised language of an old TV serial, it's the story of upstairs, downstairs, upstairs, That's the story. Now, I did say a while back that I only had one thing to say, and it was actually 5 words long. And I haven't said it yet, so don't worry, you haven't missed it. I will warn you when it's coming, and your neighbour can give you a nudge. But before I do deliver these 5 words, and I do hope I get them right now, before these 5 words come, I'd just like to tell you a story. I'd call it a joke, but that would put pressure on you to laugh at the end of it, and there's enough pressure at Christmas time without me adding to it. So it's the story of a friend of mine, as it always is. It's a story of a friend of mine who's trying to get a phone installed, and he's having a lot of trouble really with British Telecom, and actually at Clubhouse we've been having a lot of trouble with British Telecom about a phone, so this rings bells with me. And he's ringing up about the phone, and the first person he was dealing with, he went on holiday, so he got passed to somebody else, and he began to make progress with that person, and they went on holiday, and then the other person went on holiday, then he forgot the name of the first person he started with, and he just went on and on. In the end they said, yes, we can come and install a phone. He said, oh good. He said, when can you come? He said, we can come in 10 years time. And he'd got used to it by now, so he said, fine, 10 years' time. Yeah, the British Telecom man said, yes, we'll come on December the 20th in 10 years' time. So my friend said, okay. Just one thing, will you be coming in the morning or the afternoon? And the British Telecom man said, well, does it really matter? And he said, yeah, I've got the plumber coming in the morning. And about a little story about somebody who's just got used to waiting and just accepts it. A rather depressing little story, really. It's about everything taking an outrageously long time to happen. And in the end, it just wears you down. And that's what you come to expect. Expect nothing, you know, and you won't be disappointed. And I think there are Christians like that. What is angry and full of questions? And the answer is a cross examination. And also, I will leave a pause there. I think a lot of Christians are. And you say, well, why would Christians be angry? Well, I think it may be that they feel the Christian life hasn't quite delivered the goods. And they're getting used to waiting. But the longer you wait, the more resentful you get, even if you push it below the surface. You know, Christians, they'd hope for so much, but in truth, in terms of thrilling spiritual experience, they're having to make do with so little. And so, to protect themselves, they switch into limbo mode, waiting mode. Vague assertions about God having something for me sometimes, probably, maybe. But that's in the future. Well, it better be, because it certainly hasn't been in the past. But for the moment, I'll just sort of tread water. And they think, well, I'll tread water, and hopefully, when the divine moment comes, I'll be ready for it. Whenever it comes, however it comes, if ever it comes. I think there are a lot of Christians like that. I don't know if it's you or not, but I think there are a lot of Christians like that. And I do feel now that I'm ready to say the one thing I'd really like to say tonight, and it's 5 words. So here it comes. Nudge your neighbour. And the 5 words are these. The divine moment is now. The divine moment is now. And the clue was in the second reading, in which Jesus invited us to understand the time. Understand the time. The divine moment is now. Now, half of you will be saying, but that's pretty obvious, isn't it, Simon? That is pretty obvious. While the other half will be saying, The divine moment is now. What on earth are you talking about? Well, to the first group of you, all I can say is I'm sorry to raise something which is so obvious. We're not all as advanced as you. And I just hope it's as obvious in your life as it is in your head. But to the second group, I'd like to offer an explanation. The divine moment is now. If you reflect again on the story that John read to us, you'll become aware that it takes us through a number of pretty important life changes for Jesus. It takes us through a pretty important number of life changes for Jesus. Now, life changes is a phrase that caring professionals use. So I'm trying to use it as much as possible to describe what the rest of us call life's ups and downs. And you'll see here that it does take us through a whole range of experiences and emotions. And so in verse 6, Jesus leaves home. Well, that's a very big life change. Moving house is one of the great stressful activities that we undertake. But not an easy moving house is also taking a drop in status. Well, that's another very stressful activity. He became a servant. That is another very big life change, especially if you have been part of the divine Trinity. And then we read a little further on that he emptied himself. Now, emptying yourself is a very, very painful internal process. Praying, "Your will be done, not mine," is a fine prayer. But it does hurt when it happens. And the same could be said for Jesus humbling himself. We all want to be humble, but none of us want the humiliating experience. But when you pray to be humble, you're praying, of course, for a humiliating experience. And that feels awful. Then Jesus also became obedient. He became obedient to death on the cross. That is, he hung in there. He hung in there in both senses of the phrase. And hanging in there sometimes feels good, but it doesn't usually feel good. And when Jesus was hanging on the cross and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He can't have been unaware of the fact that not only did God feel a long way away, but also so did his very, very absent human friends. I wonder if that rings bells with you. But then in verse 9, another experience. That of being exalted or raised up by God. I remember I was running in Regent's Park recently. It was early. And I came across a path that had been covered in red petals from something. Just covered in red petals. And it hit me. And it was covered in red petals. And it was like a red carpet had been rolled out for me by God. I just felt like that. I felt like a red carpet had been laid out for me by God. And I ran down it and I felt all the angels were applauding me. And you probably think I'm mad. But that was important. Because to be honest, at that time I didn't feel like anybody else was applauding me. Now that was probably for very good reasons. But sometimes it is nice to be applauded. Sometimes it's nice to be raised up, to be exalted. And I was that morning, and perhaps you've had similar experiences. Well, Jesus was certainly raised up. On a scale, of course, that puts my Regent's Park experience in the shade. But the principle is the same. And then also in verse 9, Jesus is named. Another life change. Jesus is named. He's given a name that is above all names. Can this be the same person? I mean, the question I'm asking is, can this be the same person that we were reading about a few verses ago? About being humble, about being empty? Yes, it is. The same figure that hung on the cross and said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is now being named as the name that is above all names. Well, that's the story. Talk about life changes. Talk about diversity of experience. Talk about life's ups and downs. Talk about mixed moments. And you're talking about the life of Jesus. And yet each moment was the divine moment. Each moment was the divine moment. Jesus was not waiting for some vague divine moment in the future at some time. In his life, every moment was the divine moment because every moment was offered to God. So the humbling was the divine moment quite as much as the exalting. And the leaving was the divine moment quite as much as the homecoming. And so it is with each of us. The divine moment is now, if it is offered to God. The divine moment is not distinguished by what it feels like. Divine moments come in all shapes, colours, and sizes. Now, the only surefire distinguishing feature of a divine moment is that it is your now being offered to God. It's the moment you're living in. It's the day you're living in. It's the situation you're facing. This is the divine moment, if you will offer the moment to God. Do you know what makes God laugh? People talking about their future plans. The divine moment is now. It's not tomorrow. There's that famous cartoon of a character saying, "Give me a break, God. Please, give me a break." And the next picture has God saying, "This is the break." I mean, one day last week, I heard of three different people talking about me in my absence. And to a greater or lesser degree, I felt they were misjudging me, to put it politely. Now, it didn't, to me, feel very divine. But it was, in fact. It was very divine. Because it was the present. It was my present. It was my now. And viewed like that, and offered to God, it led me into a number of reflections, one of which concerned the looseness of my own tongue. You see, the divine moment is not distinguished by what it feels like. Divine moments come in all shapes, sizes, and colours. Now, the only surefire distinguishing feature of a divine moment is that it is your now being offered to God. It's the moment you're living in. It's the day you're living in. It's the situation that you're facing. The divine moment is now. Well, for a sermon consisting of five words, this one has gone on for quite long enough. And so it's time to put this story to bed. It's a familiar story to many of us, but it's a great story. In fact, it's the greatest story. So take it home with you tonight, and take it home with you this Christmas, and wrap this warm story around your cold story. Intertwine this strong life with your weak one. This story should seep, and your story should absorb. And perhaps 1991 will become for you the year when you begin to live the truth that the divine moment was not yesterday, and it's not tomorrow, but it's now.